guest is Professor Yung-Kyung Chung. And let me just take a moment, if you don't mind, Yung-Kyung, to explain her name. Her last name, we would say, her family name is Chung, and her given name is Yung-Kyung, Yung-Kyung. So we'll be addressing her as Yung-Kyung. Dr. Yung-Kyung Chung is a professor of ecumenics and world Christianity at Union Theological Seminary in New York. She's been active in Christian and Buddhist women's movements in Asia. She was formerly professor of systematic theology at Ewha Women's University in Seoul, Korea. She's the author of Struggle to Be the Sun Again and other books. There's also a very strong Buddhist connection, as we'll hear as we talk to Yung-Kyung. She spent some time as a wandering Buddhist ascetic in Asia, and has studied to be a teacher in the Kwan Um Zen School. And she is a powerful bridge, is a powerful bridge between the traditions of East and West. And she has been, almost from the very beginning, a member of the International Interreligious Peace Council. And we're really delighted to have her here. Before we get started, let me say a word or two about the topic. And the topic we've asked Yung-Kyung to speak about today is ecofeminism and peace. We'll clarify that a little bit. And here's something from our website. The connection between feminist insight into the world and human society is profoundly interdependent with ecological thinking. As Dr. Susanna Heschel, whom Yung-Kyung knows well, said at the 1993 Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago, it's not an accident that we call the Earth Mother and then proceed to treat her as we have always treated women. And I want to say I was present at that event, and Susanna Heschel was not just making a minor semantic point. She was making a major, major point. But what is the connection between feminist consciousness and ecological activism? Why aren't more women eco-activists? And how does feminist consciousness affect men? How can activists engage and embrace the eco-feminist connection? How can men and women rediscover the feminine through ecological activism? And finally, these are just sort of background thoughts. What does this discussion tell us about the evolution of culture and consciousness in our time? What can we learn from the visionaries, the pioneers, the activists in the field? Then there's a little excerpt from my own book, which is actually in reference to Thomas Berry, the late Thomas Berry. Is the planet really sacred? Well, Thomas Berry thought so. Before his death in 2009, Tom Berry had become one of the most important religious voices addressing the human relationship to the Earth and the planetary community. In his amazing book, Evening Thoughts, Reflecting on Earth as Sacred Community, he wrote, quote, "The ancient human-Earth relationship must be recovered in a new context, in its mystical as well as its physical functioning. There is need for awareness that mountains and rivers and all living things, the sky and its sun and moon and clouds, all constitute a healing, sustaining, sacred presence for humans, which they need as much for their psychic integrity as for their physical nourishment." So it's a great thought from a wonderful person who has been an inspiration, I think, to most of us. So now if I can turn to my friend Yung-Kyung and begin by saying you've been involved with the Peace Council since its beginning in 1995. And this is a question that we have begun with each time with our Peace Council guests. Can you recall an experience with that group that was particularly meaningful to you? This gives us a chance to let people know a little bit more about this remarkable group of people that is the Interreligious Peace Council. So some experience that really meant a lot to you.
Yes, I had many life-changing experiences with the Peace Council members from 1995 in Chiapa, Cambodia, Northern Ireland, Thailand, Korea, and you were there, Jim. And I really appreciate so many peace lessons I got from them. But if I have to try one most challenging life-transforming experience I had from the Peace Council was our experience in Jerusalem in the year 2000. We visited the Hebrew Union College on the Holocaust Memorial Day, and Peace Council participated in the memorial service with Hebrew Union students and faculty to remember all the people who were killed during the Holocaust. It was a really heartbreaking experience because every one of them in that auditorium lost at least one family member in the Holocaust. And their poetry, songs, and stories of Holocaust made many of us cry, and they keep saying, never again, never again, never forget, never forget. And I could totally empathize with their hurt and their determination not to allow this brutal violence happening again to their people. So, you know, I was very quiet, and I just be there with them. Then after the ceremony, we had a reception for the Peace Council with the faculty members. Everybody was so sad and in the listening mode of this victimization story by the Jewish faculty members there. And what could you say? What could you say? Anything for these grieving people? Then suddenly our Geshe-la, a small, old, 80-year-old Tibetan monk who was actually the teacher of Dalai Lama, and our beloved trusted members of Peace Council, he quietly stood up and started to speak with his broken English. And he said, you know, once Tibet was the most powerful country in our region, before we had become Buddhist. We were very powerful invaders to our neighboring countries. We made our neighbors suffer so much, including China. Then many years later, we were invaded by China and lost our country. I'm so worried that Chinese are making the same bad karma now in the way we did to them long, long times ago. I'm afraid that the future generation of Chinese would suffer to pay back this bad karma someday. I do not want them to suffer the way we Tibetan people are suffering now. Today, here in Jerusalem, we heard, never forget, never forget, never again, so many times. But you know, of course we have to grieve and remember the victims, to honor them, to honor their deaths. But at some point, we have to let go, forgive, forget, so that something really new is possible. I think we Tibetan people have to do that with the Chinese people. And you maybe do that with the Palestine people here so that real peace is possible. We have to be really compassionate toward ourselves and others. And this, you know, old man quietly sat down. Nobody could say a word after his speech. It was so quiet, and I learned the most important lesson about peacemaking on that day from this old Tibetan monk. Let go, forgive. I think everybody in that room was moved by his compassion, courage, and truth-telling. I think only person like the Geshe-la, who embodied such deep compassion and wisdom in his presence out of his life experience, would say those kind of words at the Holocaust Memorial Day at Hebrew Union in Jerusalem. You know, I think if somebody whose being does not embody his kind of deep compassion and wisdom had said something like that, what Geshe-la said on Holocaust Memorial Day, he or she would have been considered or even attacked as the most insensitive and self-righteous person who has no sympathy and just want to be politically correct. But Geshe-la's words could make people, just make people's heart open and to look into ourselves very deeply. So that day I learned that peace is possible, really, when you become peace through Geshe-la. Yeah, that was the most moving experience for me in Peace Council.
Well, I happened to be in that room that day, mm-hmm. and my wife, Seta, who is with us on the phone, also was there. And I have to say, you've described it very beautifully. And here's what's interesting. Our very first mm-hmm. conversation in this series was with Sally King, mm-hmm. who is a Quaker and a Buddhist and member of the Peace mm-hmm. Council group. And she also chose that very same moment as her most powerful memory. So I think it's sort of interesting, learning the lesson of peace by forgiving and letting go and moving on. Well, and let's move on. You often identify yourself, Young Kyung, as an ecofeminist theologian. What is an mm-hmm. ecofeminist, and what does it mean to be an ecofeminist theologian? Help us, first of all, understand that term, and then tell us a little bit more about why ecology and feminism are so intertwined.
Yeah, the word ecofeminism was invented by a French feminist philosopher, Frances de Bon, in the year 1976. She saw that the oppression of women and the oppression of nature are directly connected in this patriarchal philosophical system. In many cultures in the East and the West, especially in the West, the people identify nature with women and culture with men. This is not a really correct identification, but it is our conventional identification, nature with men and culture with nature with women and culture with men. It is based on hierarchical dualism and this Aristotelian thinking of ladder of beings. Especially the Western philosophical tradition of Plato and Aristotle considered that men are connected more closely with the spiritual or ideal world, and women are more connected with the earthly and material world. So the word like a father comes from Latin word pater. This pater also became the root word of pattern. So father signifies
the root word of pattern.
Pattern. Yeah, you have some pattern. So father signifies eternal ideal pattern, and mother. The word mother came from Latin word mater, but this mater also become a root word for matter. So here in this Western thinking, father means father, men are pattern, like ideal, unchanging thing, and mother, women, are simply a matter, material. The consequences of this dualistic, hierarchical, and also very patriarchal philosophy make men with power can use women and earth in a way they want. So they can despise and use, exploit women and nature, because women and nature are very lower being in this Aristotelian ladder of beings. So women and men, women and earth are considered for a long, long time the soulless, spiritless matter, simple material, while men are spirit-filled culture makers. So when I learned the church history and dogmatics, I was so shocked that church fathers have this serious theological discussion about whether women have a soul for like 300 years. We are laughing about it, but we are saying same thing whether animals having soul nowadays, the scientists. Of course you, animals have soul. If you have dogs and cats and birds you raise, you know they are soulful beings. And all these indigenous people know rivers have soul and trees have soul. And I think this kind of very dualistic thinking and hierarchical thinking has been the basis of sexism and capitalism and destruction of this precious earth. So ecofeminist philosophers and activists worldwide try to correct this wrong view of women and earth. We try to reimagine women and earth, spirit, soul-filled subject of this universe and this ongoing creation. Unless we see women and earth like what Thomas Berry said and what Martin Buber said, I and thou relationship and subject to subject relationship, we will not save this earth or we will not save present human civilization. So ecofeminism emerged because patriarchal philosophy made our thinking world so sick and corrupted. So this is, the corrective healing philosophical movement, also ecological movement. As a Korean feminist, I call Korean ecofeminism salimist. Salim means making things alive, and also it is the same words of women's everyday chore of nurturing and caring and building relationship. I think
let me just jump in and spell that for people. Mm. It's S-A-L-I-M. Mm-hmm. And salim means, again in Korean, help us.
Salim means making things alive, giving life. So ecofeminism is basically this caring and nurturing life and correcting this very dualistic, materialistic mode of thinking.
Let me ask you a practical question. This is so powerful and so evocative. Now, in terms of activism in the world, the ecological movement is one thing, and the feminist movement is another. The social justice movement is another. I think one of the most important things that's happening in the world today is that these various aspects of the movement for a better world, which have often been estranged from one another, seem, at least to me, to be coming together a little bit more. Do you see that happening between the ecological movement and the feminist movement, an awareness of their interpenetration?
Yes, I think it is I think it is happening everywhere, not only in academia. The ecofeminist theology is really blossoming, not only in USA, but like Latin America, Conspirados in Chile, and Ivone Guevara in Brazil, and also in the Philippines and Korea and Africa, Wangari Maathai's Green Belt Movement. Yes, and many Filipino sisters, and they start to have an organic farm. Not only just having a healthy food, but we envision what is our relationship with Earth. And we also have a place like a Genesis Farm in New Jersey, which is based on Thomas Ferry's cultural vision and spiritual vision of universe story. Unless we see as the earth as a body of God and our living mother, we all came from earth. So we see earth as a fully alive spiritual subject, we will not have any chance. So the ecological movement and feminist movement discover one another, each other, in our actual movement, because our the goal and process and philosophical groundings are so similar. We just decide, why don't we get together and develop a really penetrating mutual theory, which is ecofeminism and also ecofeminist green politics and green economic and green philosophy. So I see more and more feminists and ecologists are getting together. And I think this is the future.
You mentioned Wangari Maathai of Kenya, whose green belt, actually she won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago, and her green belt movement, I'm just realizing it's a perfect example of what you're talking about, because it was a movement that helped hundreds of thousands of women in Kenya find employment and at the same time replanted millions of trees in Kenya.
Yes, it was
a perfect melding of the two. Here's another question, something that we've talked about before, and that is the role of women in leadership roles in the world's religious traditions, especially in the dominant religions. What's your thought on that? Are you hopeful? Are you sanguine about that? Are you pessimistic, hopeful? What?
Yes, I have this thinking that if we present dominant world religions, which is most of them are very patriarchal, if these religions do not liberate themselves from the patriarchal, really Babylonian captivity of this power over mode of doing religious work and keep excluding women in the leadership position and, you know, co-creating and co-nourishing our ancient religious tradition, maybe next generation of women even stop fighting with them, fighting against the system anymore. They will simply leave the system and practice their own spirituality, taking whatever resources they can take from this ancient religious wisdom. And they will not pay any attention to outdated, dysfunctional patriarchal religious system. I think it's already happening in many places in the world. And women might reinvent or rediscover or even create women-centered, earth-centered, really inclusive new religion, which can give fullness of life to all kinds of human and earth. You know, I always say, maybe it will be something like a religion of womb of universe, where nobody speaks universe and where nobody is excluded and everybody is flourishing in that religion. I, you know, when I think about this whole connection of ecology and feminism, we really look into something, some deep wisdom from ancient goddess tradition and indigenous spiritual tradition or shamanic tradition to recover earth-honoring and women-honoring wisdom. I'm not saying that, you know, biological women are better than biological men here. No. What I'm saying is, we have to re-envision the really ancient future, women-centered culture, a new civilization which is based on mutuality, reciprocity, diversity, and sustainability, present mode of neoliberal capitalism, the macho militarism, materialistic consumerism, unlimited competition, and the survival of the fittest mode of culture eventually will destroy all of us. And all those modes of being and this production and relationality was based on monoculture of winner-takes-all kind of mentality of patriarchal capitalism. You know, the recent earthquake in Japan really makes me very sad. And I see these recent years of natural disaster, earthquake, tsunami, Katrina, is like a 911 call from our Mother Earth. She's making this emergency call to all of us. Dear my children, earthlings, if you do not change the way you live right now, this is what you are going to see every day. Please stop this nonsense, this really greedy nonsense, and live a life of caring and life of simple beauty and peace. Otherwise, this is what you're going to see. So, you know, I just feel the world religious traditions must rediscover this ancient earth-honoring spirituality, which really see earth as a God body, and God's spirit is everywhere embedded in earth textures.
That's very lovely.
Wow.
Something that we have touched on here that I think fits with that very nicely, and that I've been thinking about a lot, is the whole idea of the global commons, the idea of the common heritage of humankind, not just the physical, the earth and the air and the fire and the water and the atmosphere and outer space and so on, but also culture and language and even the internet. The idea that there is a common human heritage that is slowly being commoditized rather than recognized as the common nurturing legacy and heritage of us all. And as some folks who are listening may be aware, this has emerged as one of the new themes of focus of the Peace Council, this idea of the global commons. I wonder if you can help us to see how that connects with what we're talking about here.
Yes, like, you know, Vandana Shiva, she's eco-feminist activist from India. She said a very beautiful thing in her book, Staying Alive. She said, we have to make envision new culture based on forest principle, which is a feminine principle from her tradition, her Hindu tradition. And she said the forest principle is really based on mutuality, reciprocity, and sustainability. And she said,
forest principle?
Yeah, forest principle, and she also called it feminine principle, and she said, if the forest, the more diverse, inclusive the forest is in their, animals and plant, the better immune system they build, the more sustainable they are. I think it is applying to our human civilization. The more diverse, inclusive, sustainable, inclusive our human civilizations are, which is based on mutuality and reciprocity, we will have a better immune system in human civilization so that we can be ecologically sustainable, and also we can have a sustainable peace. Present system, which is very much, you know, based on like a three poison, what Buddhists said, which is greed, ignorance, and hatred, is not simply sustainable. economically, politically, and culturally. I love this the analysis by Buddhist scholar David Loy. He say beautiful things. He said, these three poisons of Buddhism is manifested in our time structurally. This greed as a neoliberal capitalism, and our hatred is a worldwide military-industrial complex. It is a systemized hatred and ignorance, which is corporate media and corporate academia. I think he has a real good analysis in it. And, you know,
so.
These three poisons is not just internal spirituality. We have to really transform three poisons in our system. And I think ecological and feminist thinking and what Vandana Shiva envisioned, this forest principle and feminine principle, will help us to reimagine our life, reimagine our civilization all over again. Actually, in Korean traditional prophecy, they said, with the beginning of the 21st century, this feminine energy, in energy, will rise all around the world. And it will correct this one-sided, very masculine, young energy civilization. In that movement, women should take a leadership. That is the kind of a Korean Asian side of prophecy from our ancestors. And I also remember from my study in Christian theology in the West, in Shaker tradition, you know, founder of Shaker movement said, first coming of Christ came to this world as a male body form. But second coming of Christ will come as a female body form, or female energy, so we can have a complete salvation history. Of course, these are all metaphorical religious talk, but I think there are real insight for future of our civilization.
Well, we're right at the point where I think it's appropriate to mention that you've interacted, I know, with some really extraordinary spiritual leaders around the world. And I wonder if you'd be willing to pick one of those experiences and tell us about one of your encounters with one of the world's great spiritual leaders. Why is it that we turn to these people for inspiration and guidance? And just talk to us for a moment about one meeting that you've had that's made a huge difference.
Maybe I want to share my first introduction to Buddhist meditation. And you know, when maybe you remember that I gave the keynote speech at World Council of Church, 7th Assembly of World Council of Church
in Canberra. You know,
1991, Canberra. And
yes,
it kind of put me in the world stage, but after that speech, I got so much death threat from fundamentalists, and I really was very living a fearful life. And at the time, I was invited by Harvard University to teach, but I was just totally depressed at that time. So one day, I came home from Harvard University to my apartment, and I discovered this very small Korean Buddhist meditation center called the Cambridge Zen Center. And I went there, and I was really full of suffering, and personally and, you know, career-wise. So I met Zen Master Sung San, as a Korean Zen Master.
Sung San.
And I gave, Sung San Zen Master. And in my interview with him, I gave all my soft, dramatic, you know, suffering. Oh, I'm suffering this. You know, people try to give all this death threat and, you know, even my husband at the time, who was a fundamentalist Christian, said, telling me every day, you have to repent and be a real Christian, and etc., etc. So I said, I couldn't take this anymore. And I was crying. And he just looked at me in utter stillness. And his answer was, so? You know, first noble truth of Buddhism is life is suffering. And you just to start to understand what life is. Everybody is suffering in this world. Why do you think you are so special? I just got so angry. I just want to just said, what kind of Zen master are you? Huh? You don't know psychology 101. You don't know pastoral counseling 101. I am suffering, and you at least be a little bit empathetic and sympathetic with me. And your answer is so. I was really angry, but at the same time, something really struck me, you know, and I become very quiet. And he said, well, you just start what life is. Go sit and start to meditation. That was the beginning of my meditation. And, you know, after 20 years of meditation, recently I became a Buddhist Dharma teacher under Zen Master Sung San's guidance. And through meditation, I really healed my personal psychological suffering. And suffering I encounter everywhere I go for peace work. When I got encountered with brutality and structural injustice, and I become so angry and I want to give up, I always remember that, you know, life is suffering. That's why we are here. But there is a way. There is a liberation. And every one of us can be free and happy and have a meaningful life. And that free, happy, meaningful life is possible. And it is their teaching, but I didn't just get this teaching through their words. What struck me most was their presence, their living example and embodiment of their reality in their humanness. And they helped me to love myself and this world with passion and compassion. I think that's why we need these spiritual teachers who take us along in this path of liberation. Not only we discover who we are and why we are here, but we are free enough, loving enough, and we ask our neighbors, how may I help you? I am here. You know, we can have that spaciousness and that peace and loving kindness in our heart. I think that's why we need the teachers.
You know, I can't imagine. I was going to ask you for a word or two of spiritual encouragement to people who are working as activists around the world. I can't imagine you saying anything more powerful than you just said. And I'd just like to tell people that your reference to your address at the World Council of Churches meeting in Canberra, Australia, in 1991, that's the right year, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Is legendary. This is one of the most powerful things you'll ever see, and there are recordings of it all over the net, Professor Chung's address at Canberra, where she spoke about when, as a Christian, but also a Korean, when she thinks about the Holy Spirit, she thinks about Kuan Yin. And it combined, your presentation combined recitation with Korean dance and an Australian didgeridoo player. It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And you had a lot of walkouts that day.
Yes.
From that meeting, and it's not surprising that you had a threat or two, but it's one of the most extraordinary things I think that anyone has ever seen. And I should also mention that Zen Master Sung San, S-E-U-N-G-S-A-H-N, is really the first Asian Zen master to live and teach outside of Asia for extensive periods of time, the Kwan Um School of Zen. So people will want to know more about that. Yung Kyung, I think this has just been a fantastic conversation. We're all really grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Be well.